This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala nabi al-kareem wa ala alihi wa ashabi ajma'een. So welcome back to Islam Intensive Muslim History, the second part on our history of Al-Andalus, Islamic Spain. And this will be our final lesson before Ramadan. We will then take a 4 to 5 week break for the month of Ramadan. I personally prefer taking a break in Ramadan so I can focus on my ibadat, and I hope you all do the same as well. It also gives you a time to catch up with some of the lectures that you missed out on, or to repeat any of those that you may need to brush up on. But ideally, this is a time for ibadat, and so I'm taking on a lighter workload for the month of Ramadan. So this conclusion on the history of Islamic Spain will be our final lesson for now, our only lesson for the month of April, and we will continue with this program at some point in May, perhaps the week after Eid or the week after that, depending on Qadr Allah, whatever Allah wills to happen. And we will then continue with the history of the other empires, like the Fatimids, the Mongols, the Ottomans, the Ayyubids, the Safavids. We still have quite a few empires to go through before we conclude with this program. So I'm hoping that this program on Muslim history will take us all the way into at least July, because we really have that much content still to cover. So with that, let's jump into today's topic. So last week we looked at Muslim Spain, Al-Andalus. Particularly, we looked at Umayyad Spain. So Muslims ruled over Spain for 700 years. And this is a part of our history that's often completely forgotten about. Even though the peak of Umayyad Spain was the true golden age of the Muslim Empire, that was the absolute best that this Ummah had reached as far as worldly accomplishments was considered. That at some point in time, or rather during the reign of Abdul Rahman III in specific, the Muslims of Spain were the most advanced civilization on earth in every possible way. Religion, we still are, but also economically, politically, culturally, scientifically, and in any other way that you can think of. It was the most important place on earth. So what happened? What happened to make Islamic Spain go from the peak of human civilization to something that doesn't even exist anymore and that most Muslims are not even aware of anymore? That's what we're going to cover today. So last week's history was the nice part. Last week's history was the part of the history of Muslim Spain that we feel proud of. You know, that we long for and wish we could go back and live in that era, and that we wish we could, you know, experience it and see for ourselves. What we're going to cover today is the dark part of the history. The stagnation and decline and eventual collapse of Muslim Spain. And this did not happen overnight. This is also a 300 to 400 year process where the Muslims of Spain go through a few periods of rise and falls, none of which last longer than 100 years. And so it's a time of instability, it's a time of difficulty, and it eventually ends in complete bloodshed and chaos. You know, when you look back at Muslim Spain, it's a place that has produced some of the greatest thinkers and scholars in the history of Islam. From one of my favorite tafsir scholars like Al-Qurtubi, to the great Zahiri fiqh scholar Ibn Hazm, to philosophers like Ibn Rushd, and many, many other amazing intellectuals came from this place and this time. But what happens is that when a society reaches its peak, and especially when its peak is that good, where you literally have all of this world laid out at your feet, it is very easy to fall from there. It is very easy to lose all of it, to take it for granted and to lose all of it. And you have to remember that for the bulk of Muslim history, Muslims assumed that by default, if they conquer a land, it's going to stay under Muslim rule until the end of time. This was the assumption of Muslims living in the world at that time. Because up until this point in our history, any land that the Muslims conquered became Muslim lands permanently. Right? So the Muslims conquered Syria, they conquered Iraq, they conquered Egypt, they conquered Morocco. All of these lands are still predominantly Muslim lands today. Spain was the first time in our history where Muslims conquered a land and a few centuries later they completely lost it. It was a wake-up call for the Ummah, which sadly the Ummah did not heed that wake-up call, because later on, a few hundred years later, we would lose everything in World War I. But if you go back to that time, imagine you are someone living in Spain in the time of the Umayyads, and you have everything in this world. You have money, you have power, you have technology, you have science, you have education, you have peace, you have everything you want. You would not think that Allah is going to take this away from you and give it to somebody else. Mainly because you are a Muslim and everybody else is kafir. Right? It never crossed their minds that if Muslims were not appreciative of what Allah has given them, Allah would take it away from them and give it back to the disbelievers. This didn't cross the mind of the majority of Muslims. And that's one of the reasons why the Ummah has fallen in so many parts of the world. And Spain was the first major one to fall. So what happened first? Last we spoke, we said that the Umayyad Empire, it came to an end with people fighting over power. So that began a period of time known as Muluk al-Tawa'if. The fractured kingdoms, right? Or the mini kingdoms, mini states. I think that's a better definition of it in English, mini states. So essentially, what happened was, when the Umayyads lost power, Al-Andalus split into mini states. And for the next 40 years, each of these states were at war, each claiming to be, the ruler of each state claimed to be the ruler of Al-Andalus. So like Cordova became its own state, and each of the other places became their own state. And the Muslims fell into a period of civil war known as the period of Muluk al-Tawaif, kings of provinces. And I always look back at this and I find this so fascinating that, you know, if you look at the parallel of the downfall of Islamic Spain and where we are today, that Spain, Muslims conquered it, they ruled it, it peaked, it reached its golden age, and then it split into mini states. The Ummah as a whole grew, conquest, peak, golden age, and where are we today? Where are we today as the Ummah as a whole? Mini states. What was once the Ottoman Empire is now dozens of different countries, each claiming to be the ruler of their own land. Some as small as one or two cities. Mini states. It happened on a local level with Spain. It's happening now on the global level. What will happen next? Perhaps will happen next with Spain, or perhaps something else. Allah knows best. But it's very fascinating to see how history repeats itself. You just have to look for the patterns. So, when the Muslims started fighting each other, the Christians, of course, took advantage of that. Why wouldn't they? They want their land back, right? They did not stop seeing Muslims as foreigners in their land. They did not stop seeing Muslims as conquerors. They did not stop seeing Muslims as the other. You know, for the European powers at that time, particularly the Christians in France and Spain, Muslims were the enemy. So when Muslims were fighting each other, of course they were going to step in and take advantage of that. And so they began to form alliances with different Muslim kings against other Muslim kings, to plot and plan to get the Muslims to be in a state of constant war with each other, hoping that this would destroy what was left of Muslim Spain. And it might have worked. And again, this is something that's happening today. We have the same thing happening today with America and these other Western powers allying with Saudi Arabia and the UAE against Yemen and Palestine and whoever else. What's going on here? We have Muluk al-Tawaif on a global scale. We have the disbelievers on a global scale. We have the same alliance on a global scale. And the goal is the same, to make Muslims fight each other and to hope that this brings about the end of the empire altogether. But that's not what happened with Spain. Spain would remain a Muslim land for another 300 years. Allah had other plans. And we hope that Allah has other plans for this ummah as well. So the rescue of Spain came at the hands of the leader of the Murabitun movement, Yusuf ibn Tashfin. And he is the one who managed to re-establish Spain as a Muslim land. But Spain was now no longer an individual country with its own leader. It was now an extension of Morocco. Right, because the Murabitun were at that point in time the Muslim empire that were ruling over Morocco and North Africa. So the history of the empire is very fascinating. That essentially it started off in Morocco as a group of scholars and students of knowledge, who their goal was the revival of Islamic knowledge in that area. And they eventually took over all of North and Western Africa, ruling Morocco and all those other lands, and Spain as well. Right, so their capital was in Marrakesh in Morocco. And I would highly recommend, you know, learning a bit more about its foundation, because essentially this movement started with a single scholar moving to Morocco and starting a small study circle. And his students became political leaders and scholars at the same time, and they established a state in that part of the world, which, again, you know, this is at that point where the Abbasids were weak. And people in North Africa and West Africa were not a priority. They were being neglected by what was left of the Abbasid Empire. They needed their own leader. They needed their own empire. And so from amongst them rose up a powerful dynasty called the Murabitun. And this dynasty took over all of that part of Africa. And then the news reached their leader, Yusuf ibn Tashfin. The news reached him that the Christians are plotting to take over Spain. And if you don't do anything about it, this is it. We are going to lose this land to the disbelievers. So Yusuf ibn Tashfin led an army of 60,000 people into Spain. He defeated the forces of the Christians and their allies, and he annexed Spain and made it part of the Murabitun Empire. And so Spain was now saved from leaving Islam, and it became a part of this empire. Now, the Murabitun didn't last long, right? As an empire, it lasted about 107 years. A very small empire. That's probably one of the reasons why you don't know about it, is that it was a very tiny empire in terms of how long it lasted. Compared to the Abbasids, the Umayyads, the Ottomans, 107 years is a very, very short period of time. And this conquest of Spain takes place towards the tail end of the Murabit rule, right? So the Murabitun, they end up not really ruling Spain for very long, but what their conquest did do was that it gave Spain a chance to survive, and perhaps a chance to turn things around, and a chance to regrow, and a chance to return to normalcy. But that's not what ended up happening. So the Murabitun, they were a Maliki empire in North Africa, and they established Spain, they established upon the Maliki mother, but the reality is even on the Umayyads, Spain was already a Maliki land. That's probably one of the reasons why it was easy for them to accept the Murabitun as their leaders. So after Yusuf ibn Tashfin passed away, his son Ali ruled for a while as well. And then what happened after that was that the Murabitun lost the entire empire. All of North and West Africa and Spain, this entire empire was taken over in a coup by a new movement from North Africa called the Muwahidun. And so, as North Africa switched from being a Murabit empire to a Muwahid empire, the same thing happened with Islamic Spain. But the Murabitun are important. It's important for us to know the role that they played in our history, in both the history of Africa and the history of Spain. In Spain, we know that they were responsible for preventing Spain from becoming a Christian country very early. Had the Murabitun not stepped in, the history of Islamic Spain would have been 400 years, not 700 years. Them stepping in allowed Muslims to remain in that region for another 300 years. But even with North Africa, we see with the Murabitun the potential of a global Islam that was not Arab in its nature. That until now, whatever empires we discuss, the Abbasids, the Umayyads, these were all Quraysh, right? Until now, we've only been discussing the Quraysh. The Abbasids are the descendants of Abbas, and the Umayyads are the descendants of Marwan ibn Hakam. These are Quraysh, right? These are the Arabs. And of course, the leadership was with the Arabs for the first few hundred years. It was the most respected tribe in Arabia. But Islam claimed to be a universal religion. So was there room for other people to grow? Was there room for other empires to grow? Was there room for other people to become leaders and to have leadership roles and influential historical roles in the Muslim world? The Murabits were the first example of yes. They were the first example of a non-Arab state that was successful. That these were Berbers, North Africans, who had established for themselves an empire. An empire that was founded upon Islamic knowledge, justice, and piety, and was known for these things. It was an empire established upon jihad and da'wah. And it was a sign that when the Arabs got lazy or fell into this dunya, or when they had lost their ways, Allah could allow power to rise in other parts of the Muslim world. You see, just like until this point in time, just like Muslims thought that Allah would never take power away from them, the Arabs thought the same too. They thought that they are the Quraysh, they are the family of the Prophet ﷺ, his tribe, and therefore power will always be with them. But that's not how it works. Allah gives the kingdom to whom He wills, He takes it away from whom He wills. And it's not necessary that the leadership is always with the Quraysh. And while we have to stop and discuss this hadith that's often misquoted, or rather there's a difference of opinion on how it's interpreted. So when the Ansar wanted to establish their own leader in Medina after the death of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the response from Umar and Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu was that the Prophet ﷺ said that the leader must be from the Quraysh. And so Abu Bakr was chosen as the leader, and then Umar, and then Osman, Ali, the Umayyads, the Abbasids, all of these are the Quraysh. So the difference of opinion is, does that hadith, the leader needs to be from the Quraysh, does this apply until the end of time? Or was that specific to that point in time? Right? You see, this is an important thing that we need to keep in mind about hadith. One of the problems in our time is that a lot of people take a very literalist interpretation of every hadith. Like, they don't look at the context, they don't look at why did the Prophet say something, whatever audience was it meant for. They just take it as a general statement. And so, like, I've heard people saying that, oh, the Ottomans weren't caliphs because they weren't Quraysh, and the Prophet said only the Quraysh can be caliphs. I mean, this is a ridiculous statement to make, honestly, because historically, at least from the time of Muhammad the Conqueror onwards, the Ottomans were considered caliphs. They were, by the Ummah. Nobody looked at them and said, oh, you're not the caliph because you're not Qurayshi. I mean, that comes across as racist. I understand people are following it based on hadith, so it's not racist because they're following based on hadith, but it comes across to the average person in this way. So, what is the correct understanding of that hadith, that the leader must be from the Quraysh? The understanding that I follow and which seems to be strongest is that was talking specifically for Arabia in that generation after the Prophet ﷺ. Why? Because the Bedouin Arabs and the tribes surrounding Makkah and Medina would not follow anyone other than the Quraysh. Had anybody else come into power at that point in time, there would be rebellions, there would be the end of the empire. It would crumble. Nobody would take them seriously. The only people that the average Arab respected enough to treat as a leader were the Quraysh. So understanding the mindset of his people, understanding the mindset of the Bedouin Arabs, the Prophet ﷺ said this as a statement for that time, that the Quraysh had to remain in power during that period. Now, hundreds of years later, where the word Quraysh doesn't really mean anything anymore, you follow whoever's in the leader, right? Islam has been established. Is it still necessary that the leader is from the Quraysh? Some taking this hadith literally say yes, others taking this hadith contextually say no. I fall into the second camp. I regard the hadith as contextual. It was referring to that first generation of Islam, that it was necessary that the Khulafa Rashidin and the first empire, the Umayyads, were from the Quraysh. That was necessary for the consolidation of power within the Ummah, for people to take them seriously, and for the growth of the Ummah at that point in time. Once Islam was established in the world, it was no longer necessary that the person in power be from the Quraysh. And so we got the Murabits, we got the Muwahids, we got the Ottomans, we got the Mongols, we got all these other people from other parts of the world coming into power, and all of this is fine. All of this is fine. Because it is not a wajib that the ruler is from the Quraysh. It was simply a contextual statement related to a particular political situation, and Allah knows best. So a lot of the empires we are going to study moving forward are non-Arab empires. The Murabits are not Arab, they are Berber, not Africans. The Muwahids are non-Arab, they are Berber, not Africans. The Ottomans, the Seljuks, they are Turks. Right, the Mamluks, they are Turkish or Balkan slaves. The Safavids are Iranian, they are Persian. So, not Arabs. And that's fine. Right, so I hope that's cleared up as we now move away from the Qurayshi empires into the non-Qurayshi empires. I hope that's clear, that the idea that the leader has to be from the Quraysh is not necessarily the best way to understand that hadith, and Allah knows best. So kingdoms rise and kingdoms fall, and this is something Allah mentions in the Quran in Surah Ali Imran, chapter number 3, verse 26 and 27, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, قُلِ اللَّهُمَّ مَالِكُ الْمُلْكُ تُؤْدِي الْمُلْكَ مَنْ تَشَاءُ وَتَنْزِئُ الْمُلْكَ مِنْ مَنْ تَشَاءُ وَتُعِزُّ مَنْ تَشَاءُ وَتُذِلُّ مَنْ تَشَاءُ بِيَدِكَ الْخَيْرِ إِنَّكَ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ. Say, O Allah, King of all kings, you give the kingdom to whomever you will, and you take away the kingdom from whomever you will. You give dignity and honor to whomever you will, and you cause disgrace to whomever you will. All good is in your hands. You have power over everything. تُولِجُ اللَّيْلَ فِي النَّهَارِ وَتُولِجُ النَّهَارَ فِي اللَّيْلِ وَتُخْرِجُ الْحَيَّ مِنَ الْمَيِّتِ وَتُخْرِجُ الْمَيِّتَ مِنَ الْحَيِّ وَتُرْزُقُ مَنْ تَشَاءُ بِغَيْرِ حِسَابٍ. You cause the night to turn into day, and the day to flow into night, and you bring forth life from that which is dead, and death from that which is life, and you provide for whomever you will without any restriction. So in this beautiful set of verses, we see the different things that Allah provides for us, from life to time to wealth to honor and dignity to kingdom itself, that Allah decides who is in power, and he takes it away from someone and he gives it to somebody else. And the question is, who is it that Allah gives power to, and who is it that Allah takes power from? And the answer to that is that when people are using their power in a way that is pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he will leave them in power for a long time, as he did with many of these empires. But when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, either Allah has infinite knowledge, and if in his infinite knowledge he knows that some people are going to abuse the power, or he knows that somebody else is going to be better for that land, or he knows that people are not appreciating what he has given them, that Allah can take it away and give it to somebody else. And so the point here is this idea that the Muslims had back then, that we've taken over the land, it's ours until the end of time. This is an incorrect idea. Allah gives kingdom to whom he wants, and he takes it away from whom he wants. He didn't say he gives kingdom to the believers and he takes it away from the disbelievers. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can return a land from the possession of the believers to the disbelievers if the believers are not using it in a way that is pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And in many ways, that's what happens with Spain. So let's move on to the last of the kingdoms of Spain, the Muwahidun. And by the names I mentioned in brackets is what they are known as by the West, right? So the West know the Murabits as Al-Muwarid, and they know the Muwahid as Al-Muwahid, right? But these are the Muwahidun in Arabic. So the Muwahidun, they were the rivals of the Murabitun, and they took over all of their lands. And they did not last very long. So the Muwahidun were like a extremist movement, right? They were like an extremist movement. They followed, they essentially had their own understanding of Islam, which was like almost like Mu'tazila in Aqidah and Zahiri in Fiqh. That they were very philosophical when it came to the unseen, but very literal and hardcore when it came to Fiqh. It's a very strange combination. And they essentially took over all these lands, and they tried to force this understanding of Islam upon the people living in these lands. And the people rebelled against that, and you know, that caused a lot of unrest and chaos. So for example, they were very hardcore in their fiqh. And if you look at the fiqh of Spain before this, it was a very relaxed fiqh compared to what the Muwahids had, right? If you look at the Maliki and Zahiri fiqh of Spain, a lot of things were considered halal or acceptable or fine that the Muwahids considered flat out haram. So you can imagine people for hundreds of years are following a certain mazhab, and suddenly this new guy comes into power and he tells you whatever your forefathers have been doing is haram, and they just go around getting rid of things. You can imagine the instability that causes in the land. To build upon that, there's racism as well, because these individuals going around trying to enforce a hardcore extreme understanding of Islam upon the people are non-Arab, right? They are the Berbers of North Africa, and the people living in Spain for hundreds of years are the Quraysh, the Umayyads, the descendants of the Arabs. And so racial tensions flare up. You know, who are you to teach us our religion? That is what the Arabs are saying. And they would say, we want Arabs in power, and we want the Quraysh in power. And what happened to leadership being from the Quraysh? And so all of this begins to boil. And so the Muwahids, they are unable to truly establish Spain as a Muwahid state. They're able to hold it for about 100 years, but it's not anywhere near what it was in the time of the Umayyads. It's a time of tension. There's racial tension, there's Aqidah tensions, there's fiqh tension, there's philosophical tension, there's tension between the Christians and the Muslims. It's not a happy period. One of the things that the Muwahids did do was that because they were so deep into philosophy and they spread this philosophy throughout their lands, this philosophy eventually reaches the Christians and it begins to influence Europe. And so the Christians of Europe, right till today, modern liberal philosophy, a lot of its roots go back to the philosophy that they learned from the philosophers of Spain during the Muwahid Empire, particularly Ibn Rushd. Right? So Ibn Rushd, known in the West as Averroes, he was a philosopher who lived about 900 years ago. Right? So whatever we're discussing now is around 900 years ago. This is when Spain fell about 800 years ago. We're talking 100 years before that, the Muwahid era, 900 years ago. Right? So when the Murabits and the Muwahids were ruling Spain, Ibn Rushd lived in Spain. He was born while the Murabits were ruling, and he died while the Muwahids were ruling. And he essentially became famous during the Muwahid era as a philosopher. Particularly, he expounded upon Aristotle's philosophy, and he brought it to a new generation. And so many Europeans traveled to Spain, learned Arabic, and studied philosophy under Ibn Rushd, and took it back to their lands. And in this we had the birth of the Renaissance. So really the modern world, if you want to find that exact link between the modern world and the Muslim world, and where that split happened, it's during the time of the Muwahids. That this empire that was simultaneously extreme and philosophical, their obsession with philosophy led to the Western obsession with philosophy, which led to the birth of the Renaissance and the birth of the modern world. So, armed with philosophy, the West begins to grow. They begin to rise up. Their Dark Age ends. And the Dark Age of the West coincided with the Golden Age of Islam. And so, the end of the Dark Age of the West coincides with the beginning of the decline of Islam. As an empire, not as a religion. Islam is still, alhamdulillah, the most practiced religion in the world. It is the most practiced religion in the world. Right? There may be more Christians in number, but the most practiced religion in the world today is Islam. But the empire began to fall and began to crumble then and there. So we see this curve that the Europeans were going downhill, Dark Age, Dark Age, Dark Age. The Muslims were going uphill, peaking. And then suddenly there's a split. It goes in the opposite direction. That philosophical knowledge and scientific knowledge and all of this is transferred from the Muslims to the Europeans during these 300 to 400 years. And we see the end of the Muslim world in Spain and the beginning of a modern Europe that eventually grows into what it is today. So the Muwahids could not hold their power in Spain. They had to deal with rebellions from amongst the Arabs. They had to deal with rebellions from amongst the Christians. Eventually, they lost their power to a Christian alliance, and Spain fell back into turmoil, very similar to the Muluk al-Tawa'if period. And this remained the case for almost 100 years. So there's still Muslims in Spain after the downfall of the Muwahids, but there's no Muslim empire in Spain. We now once again have mini states, some Christian, some Muslim, almost all of them at war with each other. Greed and racism have gripped the hearts of the Muslims. Everybody wants to be the king of Spain, and they don't care which Muslims they have to betray, which Muslims they have to kill, whatever it is, to become the king of Spain. Under this greed, they absolutely destroy whatever is left of their own kingdom. And over the next 100 years, Spain just begins to completely unravel and fall apart. The Christians, seeing this happen, they begin to take over the lands. either by bribing the Muslim kings or by killing them or by deceiving them. But slowly, more and more provinces fall to the Christians, and the Muslim parts of Spain become smaller and smaller and smaller until there's just one tiny kingdom left. And then on the 12th of Jamadul Awal, 896 years after Hijra, which is 800 years after Tariq ibn Ziyad marched into Spain and conquered it in the reign of Walid ibn Abdul Malik, 800 years later, the Christian rulers of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, they take over all of Spain. And it becomes a Spanish Christian kingdom, which it remains until today. For 800 years, Muslims reigned Spain. They say for 700 years they ruled Spain, and the last 100 years was just chaos and bloodshed. But the real dark event, you know, the one that the rivals what happens with the Mongols a few 100 years later, is the Inquisition. Actually, the Mongols happened before this, right? But the Inquisition of Spain. So this is about 200 years after the Mongols sacked Baghdad. So the Christians now begin to give the Muslims an ultimatum. Get out of Spain or die, or convert to Christianity. Right? There's no jizya. Muslims still gave them full freedom of religion. For the entire 800-year period, Christians could live in complete peace and safety in Spain under Muslim rule. They thrived under Muslim rule, as did the Jews. But Christians come into power, and it is a massacre. A complete and total massacre. To such an extent that the Muslim population drops to 0%. Everybody either flees the country, dies, or converts to Christianity while remaining secretly a Muslim. Now, one can argue that there were still Muslims in Spain for at least 100 years after this, but these were secret Muslims. These were people who were openly Christian. They were wearing the cross and going to church and practicing Christianity, but then at home, hidden away in a small desk drawer, they would have a Quran. You know, when no one's watching, they'd pray Salah, and they'd quietly teach their children about Tawheed and about the Quran and about the Prophet Muhammad, and they'd tell them to keep it a secret. And so the Christians began to look for signs. You know, they began to look for Qurans. They began to look for prayer rugs. They began to look for who's taking a bath on a Friday. You know, people who's making wudu. And any sign they could find that somebody was practicing any elements of Islam, they would kill that family. They would just kill them. And so eventually, Islam disappears from Spain. I mean, how many generations can you maintain a secret religion for? Eventually, your children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren are not going to remember. They're only going to be following what's the dominant culture. And Christianity is once again the dominant culture of Spain, and so that becomes the norm. Now, it's interesting that the Christians of Spain and whichever lands they move to afterwards, like Mexico, they still maintain many elements of Muslim culture. Unknowingly, they don't even know it's Muslim culture. For example, you'll notice a lot of these Christian women from these lands, their names are Salma and Alia and other names like this. Where do these names come from? These are Muslim names, right? And there may be other things in their culture. If you go and you spend time with them, you'll see a lot of elements of Muslim culture that they assume is Christian culture. It's the remnants of their great-great-great-grandfathers who were secretly Muslim. And those remnants remain today. So Spain becomes a Christian country. It remains so until today. It's only in the past 100 years, because of secular democracy, that Islam has slowly started to grow in Spain again. But of course, as a minority religion, with just a few masjids here and there, and a lot of their rights restricted, I don't know if you would ever see what happened in Spain happen again. The rise of a European Muslim empire that was so powerful, that's like, it honestly sounds like fiction, but it's our history. So from the year 95 AH until 896 AH, Muslims were a dominant force in Spain. We had the Umayyad Empire for 290 years. We had a period of civil war after that. We had the Murabits after that. We had the Muwahids after that. We had another period of civil war after that. And then we had the secret Muslims after that. And then only the entire land fell back into Christian land. And that was the end of Islamic Spain. And with that, we come to the end of our history of Islamic Spain. I hope you found this beneficial and enlightening. It gives us a lot to think about. Just a few lessons that we can derive from this before we close off. You know, one of the things that fascinates me about Islamic Spain is how different the Umayyads of Al-Andalus were from the Umayyads before them. When we study the early Umayyads, most of them we couldn't say many good things about. They were not very religious. They were very indulged in this dunya. They oppressed their people. But we can't say that about the Umayyads of Spain. The Umayyads that ruled Spain for the 290-year period were, for the most part, just rulers who established the Sharia and who built such a glorious empire that benefited everybody. Really, the empire they built benefited everybody, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, that they excelled in deen and dunya. And you know, this is something that's really, really fascinating, that the Umayyads of Spain were just, they were knowledgeable about the religion, they were knowledgeable about this world, they contributed to the spread of knowledge, they contributed to the development of science and technology. What was different? I can think of a few things that were different. Number one is learning from the mistakes of one's forefathers. So obviously, when Abdurrahman ibn Muawiyah goes on the run and he spends all those years in exile, he must have thought about what went wrong. What did his forefathers do so wrong for the entire Muslim world to turn against them and for people to assassinate the entire family? He must have thought about this. He must have realized the mistakes of his forefathers, and he must have decided that when he establishes a new empire, he's not going to repeat their mistakes. This is what I assume from seeing the difference between the Umayyads before him and from him onwards, that he must have learned from the mistakes of his forefathers. The early Umayyads were the first ever Muslim empire, and they made all those rookie mistakes, those beginner mistakes, and that's why they didn't last so long. The next Umayyad empire, those of Spain, they had already 100 years of experience to learn from, and they built upon that experience, and they were able to really make a difference. Number two is that the Umayyads of Spain only had to concentrate on one land. And because it was one land that has everything you need, they were able to do justice to that land and to develop it so beautifully. That had their attention been diverted across many different lands, as it would later on be with the Murabits and the Muwahids, they might not have been able to do as much as they did. But because it was just that one land, they were able to truly just focus on building it into something beautiful and amazing. And number three is that it wasn't just the Umayyads that contributed to that land having a golden age during their reign. It wasn't just the kings. It was everybody. That was the point in time when Muslims began to peak everywhere. That we are now, at that point in time, we are reaching the 300-year mark of Muslim history. And Muslims had now been around for 300 years. And they had established power in many countries across three continents. And so, at this point, Muslims blossomed in every field. Because that was the natural progression of that rise. That they were building in every field for 300 years. And so in that period, everything reaches its peak in both the Abbasid and the Umayyad empires, because the Abbasid and the Umayyads were ruling very differently from each other, but they both experienced the golden age at the same time. It's not necessarily to do with the rulers, but to do with the natural progression on the ground from the average Muslim as well. But the rulers played a role for sure. For sure they played a role, because with Harun al-Rashid and his children and with the Umayyads of Spain, you see rulers who were focused on the development of their lands and the funding of education, and so that definitely played a very important role in the establishment of the Golden Age. So one of the lessons we can take from there is that, you know, this idea that all the Umayyads were bad, completely wrong idea. There were many great Umayyads in our history. From Muawiyah radiallahu anhu to, by the way, Usman radiallahu anhu was an Umayyad, he was the first Umayyad caliph, right? Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, Abdul Rahman ibn Muawiyah, Abdul Rahman the second, Abdul Rahman the third, many, many amazing people. And so it is not fair to talk so badly about an entire family of Muslims. Rather, for those that were in the wrong, we stay quiet and we leave it to Allah. And Allah is Ghafoor al-Rahim. He will judge them in His perfect wisdom, in His perfect justice, and His perfect mercy. And for those that were good, we talk about their good, and we ask Allah to accept it from them and forgive them for their mistakes. Then we have the lesson about the link between the East and the West. That we have these two worlds that seem alien to each other. The Muslim world and the Western world. But they weren't always alien together. Islamic Spain is where the two were one. Islamic Spain was at that point in time the West. In fact, for Muslims living in Iraq and Arabia, they often refer to that part of the Muslim world as Al-Maghrib, the West. They literally called it the West, right? Because that's why it was West to them. And the Muslims of Al-Maghrib, which was the Murabitun Empire and you know, that part of the world, the Western Africa and Spain, they were, that land, Spain specifically, was where Christians and Muslims intersected the most, and where the Renaissance was born, where Aristotle philosophy spread to the West. Really, that is the strongest link between the Muslim world and the modern world. Islamic Spain was the strongest link historically between the two. Number three, Muslims fell when they became caught up in this world and started fighting over territories, which is what we see today. All around us today, we see the same thing. Muslims fighting over territories, you know, which city belongs to which country. Muslims caught up in this world chasing after the dunya. That caused Islamic Spain to fall. We are not going to fall out of what we are in today as long as we head down those roads. That really we are dealing with the Muluk al-Tawaif on a global level today. And as an ummah, we really have to figure out a way forward. Otherwise, the same thing is going to happen on a global level that happened on Spain back then. And the sad thing, the last point that I'll close off on. When you go around the world today and you ask people, Muslim or non-Muslim, about Islamic Spain, the average person doesn't even know it existed. They think that it was always a Christian land. They always think that Spain was always a Christian land. The idea that Muslims were living in Spain for 800 years and that there was a golden age of an Umayyad Andalus, this is something unheard of to the average person. We have to ask ourselves why. Why is this not in our Islamic history curriculums? Why is this not in the Spanish history curriculums? Why is this something that we don't talk about enough? Because this is an important part of our legacy. It's an important part of our history. And it's something we can learn a lot of lessons from. So we'll end off on that point, give you something to think about. Why is it that Muslims today don't really know about the history of Islamic Spain? And with that, we come to this conclusion. Be sure to check out our Ramadan resources section for more lectures and resources to help you through the month of Ramadan. We will continue with our Islamic history series after Ramadan. Subhan rabbil izzati amma yasifun wa salamun alal mursalin walhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.